morning. This is session 221. And Becky Johns is supposed to be the chair, but I don't see Becky. I know Becky. She's a wonderful person, but I don't know where she is. So I'm named the assertive teacher, and I am just going to introduce us and start it, even though I'm the speaker. Okay?
Shouldn't we have someone with a priesthood to do it?
Well, I have the priesthood, Clifton, so there's no problem there. Okay. So the title of our session is Priesthood Matters, Should Mormon Women Follow the Example of the Catholic Women Priest Movement? Now, my fellow speaker here today, and Jill, I didn't even ask you how you say your last name. Just like it looks. Peter Fesso. Jill Peter Fesso is joining me. We're not going to do the regular speech and then respondent. Rather, we felt, as Jill and I have been communicating in the last 2 weeks, we felt that it would be more effective if she started out by giving you an overview of the women priest movement in the Catholic Church, because I am responding to that and asking the question about whether Mormon women should follow this example. So we're going to start with Jill, and then I will give my talk, and then we hope that we can have some dialogue with you, the audience. So Jill Peter Fesso is a recent graduate. She just finished her PhD at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her doctoral dissertation was on the women priest movement. She also has a couple of master's degrees, and in one of these, she did her work on the Mormon women's I'm not afraid of saying the word vagina, but I didn't know what the exact title was. It's the Mormon Women's Vagina Monologues or Vagina Testimony. So she did her one of her master's theses on that. So she's been working on Mormon things as well as on the Catholic issues. So we will turn the time over to Jill now. She's going to give us the overview, and then to introduce myself, if you don't know me. I am Margaret Toscano. I'm an assistant professor going up for tenure this year. I may end up being the oldest person to get tenure, hopefully, knock on wood. And I teach classics and literature and all sorts of interesting things here at the University of Utah, and I've written a lot about Mormon feminism.
Morning. Certainly, the Roman Catholic priesthood is not identical to the office of priesthood in the Mormon Church. Yet, there are enough similarities between the Catholic and Mormon priesthoods that this session is invaluable, perhaps even prescient. This session is based upon a question. Has the time come for Mormon women who want the priesthood to emulate Roman Catholic women priests who have claimed Catholic priesthood outside of institutional church approval? This question takes an unapologetically activist stance. Our session today and Margaret's forthcoming proposal suggest something must be done and not simply discussed. My contribution to this discussing and doing stems from my own research on RCWP, Roman Catholic Women Priests. Started in 2002, almost exactly 10 years and 1 month ago today, RCWP is a group of Roman Catholic women who have defied the Vatican and claim to have been, quote, validly, if illegally, ordained deacons, priests, and bishops in the Roman Catholic Church. To date, there are about 125 RCWP women worldwide, primarily in Western Europe and North America, and more than two-thirds of the women are in the U.S. I've been asked to give you a quick background on RCWP as a way of introducing Margaret's proposal, so I'll do that. And then I will conclude with 10 points that I think are the most important things for you all to think about as you consider moving forward with emulating RCWP. The Catholic Church does not ordain women. Canon Law 1024 states explicitly, quote, only a baptized male validly receives sacred ordination. The Church says that a male-only priesthood has nothing to do with equality. The fact women cannot be ordained does not mean they are unequal. The Vatican's position is this. Women have never been priests at any time in Catholicism's 2,000-year history. The institutional church offers two major reasons that women cannot be ordained in Catholicism. The fundamental reason is this. A male-only ordination structure is part of an unbroken universal tradition that goes back to Jesus Christ himself. Jesus chose only men as his apostles, therefore only men can be priests. The theological reason is this. The priest is a sacramental sign of Jesus Christ. The priest must act in persona Christi, that is, must emulate Christ in his maleness. Roman Catholicism is a sacramental tradition. Christ and salvation are accessed through the sacramental encounters of the church, which the priest facilitates. So in short, and this is my crude paraphrase, sacraments would not work properly at the hands of a woman priest. In the 1960s and 70s, Catholic women began asking and arguing for women's ordination. They knew the church was opening itself up to the modern world through Vatican II. These women saw Protestant denominations one by one start to ordain women. And these women felt emboldened by social and cultural feminist forces. Yet the more they asked for women's ordination, the louder the Vatican said no. In 1977, the church document Inter in Signores laid out the reasons why women can never be ordained Catholic priests. Those were the points I just made. Inter in Signores also acknowledged the pain women must feel not being able to be ordained, but they said that any call to the priesthood that women were experiencing was not, in fact, a genuine call to priesthood. In 1994, Pope John Paul II issued an apostolic letter, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, affirming the male-only priesthood and barring discussion of the issue altogether. Enter Roman Catholic women priests. The RCWP movement was started by Austrian and German women in 2002. In the first public ordination ceremony, seven women were ordained priests on a boat on the Danube River. No Catholic church would host the ordination, obviously, and so organizers chose a riverboat location so as to control attendance and avoid diocesan jurisdiction. These original ordinands became known as the Danube Seven. The first North American ordination took place in 2005. The first U.S. ordination took place in 2006, and the first ordination of a Latin American woman took place in 2010. From the beginning, RCWP's women have asserted that they do not wish to break from the church. Rather, they want to renew and reimagine the church. They claim to love the church deeply and long to see it thrive, but they believe that Canon Law 1024 is unjust and needs to be broken. They look to the examples of Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela when they think about civil disobedience. They admit their actions are illegal because they break canon law. However, they claim to be validly ordained in spite of this illegality because they say they were ordained by male bishops who stand in the line of apostolic succession. As of May 2008, by Vatican decree, all of RCWP's women are excommunicated. Technically, in Vatican parlance, the women have, by their actions, excommunicated themselves. So who are these women who have challenged the church and excommunicated themselves to save it? Most of the women are older, in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. These are the women who long held hope for women's ordination. When it became apparent the church would not change its position, the women saw the need for dramatic action. They wanted to see women's ordination in their lifetime, and RCWP seemed the best way for this to happen. RCWP's women are incredibly well-educated. The program requires at least a Master of Divinity or equivalent. Many of the women have that and more before entering the program. RCWP's women serve as priests. They have small communities, sometimes house churches of 10 to 20 people, sometimes larger churches of around 100. And they say Mass, perform baptisms and weddings. They anoint the sick. They hear confessions. They have a variety of ministries. They wear vestments, albeit simpler ones than the ones the men wear. RCWP's women are worker priests. They are not financially supported by the church, obviously, nor by the RCWP movement. The women must then hold outside jobs as teachers, nurses, attorneys, psychologists, and social workers. Some of them live off of retirement pensions. RCWP's women, interestingly, do not adhere to mandatory celibacy, as male priests must. Many of the women are wives and widows. Many have birth children, adopted children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. A number of the women are openly gay. The women priests argue that their family experiences make them a different kind of priest, if not a better kind of priest, than the celibate males currently running the show. RCWP's women have found the church's excommunication decree painful, but they believe that excommunication is a man-made law only. They believe they are right with God, perhaps even more so on account of their struggle for ordination. So here are the 10 points that I think are especially relevant as we begin our discussion. Number one, the Danube Seven modeled their actions after those of the Philadelphia 11. In 1974, Episcopalian women in the U.S. were seeking ordination to the priesthood. These women found retired bishops in good standing to ordain them. While their ordinations were initially deemed invalid, by 1976, which is just 2 years later, Episcopal women could be legally and validly ordained. So in short, the Catholic women borrowed their strategy from the Episcopalian women. The Philadelphia 11 have succeeded in changing church policy. The Danube 7 have not yet. Two, assuring critics and supporters alike of validity and apostolic succession is essential. RCWP stumbled out of the gate because one of their first ordaining bishops had questionable legitimacy in the church. While RCWP claims to have since rectified this, it has been all too easy for many to dismiss them as being part of an illegitimate lineage. This is a source of confusion that RCWP would have done well to avoid altogether at the outset. Point three, location, location, location. In Catholicism, sacred space is key. All sacramental actions, from masses to weddings to ordinations, take place within the sacred space of Catholic churches. This special Roman Catholic space is not, however, available to RCWP's women, obviously, so they have had to look elsewhere for sanctuary. That is to say, they have had to make sacred non-Catholic spaces. Number four, some of the women have been ordained secretly in what RCWP calls catacomb ordinations. Many of these women are religious sisters. Some are lay women who work for the diocese. Catacomb priests would lose their livelihood in the church if they were discovered. These women are priests, but they do not function publicly as priests. Number five, but RCWP is not all about secrecy. In fact, a significant portion of the movement's strategy has been to accommodate local news media. Press coverage of RCWP ordinations has been largely positive, especially when church officials react angrily and are cited on record, slamming women who are grandmothers, lifelong Catholics, and pillars of their local communities. RCWP also uses YouTube and Google videos to publicize their existence. Because the image of a Catholic priest is so ingrained in popular imagination, they seek to disrupt that visual with videos and pictures of a woman's body at the altar. Number six, not surprisingly, RCWP has faced much criticism. They delight in much of the Vatican's outrage, saying that they know they are pushing the right buttons because, quote, we have gotten the bear to growl. Some very ugly things are said about the women online, in blogs and comment boards. They expected this. What has been most surprising and painful to them is the criticism they've faced from feminist theologians and scholars who have long advocated for women's ordination. Many of these longtime women's ordination activists accuse RCWP of replicating the system in place instead of modeling the drastic changes that some Catholic feminists have long envisioned. Number seven, part of RCWP's struggle with feminist scholars is around complementarity, which is the idea that men and women are fundamentally different and have distinct roles to play. The Roman Catholic Church uses complementarity to argue for why women cannot be priests. RCWP uses complementarity to argue that women should be priests, to bring women's experience and perspective to the fore. Gender complementarity flies in the face of today's theories of gender, and this too goads some Catholic feminist scholars. Number eight, interfaith relationships have been essential to RCWP's success. Ordinations take place in Protestant churches and Jewish temples. Many RCWP communities rent or are gifted worship space from ecumenical advocates. I do not yet know of any partnership between RCWP and Mormon supporters, but maybe this can be forthcoming. Number nine, RCWP is very much rooted in ongoing debates in the Roman Catholic Church today, specifically around questions of authority, the conservative-liberal divide, and the question of who is the church, the hierarchy, who make the rules, or the laity in the pews. RCWP eschews hierarchical authority and argues that the church is the people. We are church, they say. The hierarchy, of course, sees the situation quite differently. My final point is to acknowledge the tension inherent in what the women priests are doing. They want to change the church, empower women, and elevate the laity, but they're doing this by emulating much of the church's existing structures. I titled my dissertation Transgressive Traditions for this very reason. Yes, what the women are doing is extremely transgressive. And yet, what they're doing is also traditional, that is, in keeping with certain aspects of Catholic tradition. This is their challenge. What they are doing is creative. How to create this new model of priesthood, how to bring women into the system, and how to change the system all takes much creative, constructive work. And where there is creativity, there is tension and debate and disagreement. RCWP's women agree that women should be priests, and they've risked excommunication to make that happen. But where they go from there, they do not always know, and they certainly do not always agree. As far as the future goes, they have found themselves relying largely on faith.
My talk today is not simply an intellectual exploration of whether Mormon women should follow the example of some of their Catholic sisters by being privately ordained to the priesthood through LDS men with valid priesthood authority. Rather, I want to act boldly, and I want to encourage you to act boldly. I am giving an impassioned plea to both leaders and members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to accept the revelation God gave to the church in 1842 through the prophet Joseph Smith when he addressed the newly formed Relief Society in Nauvoo. The minutes to those meetings are now online as part of the Joseph Smith papers, published by the LDS Church itself. If you have not read them, you should. They are both prophetic and revolutionary. They stand as a witness that God has ordained that LDS women should be ordained. In a series of speeches between May and August of 1842, Joseph Smith announced to the Relief Society that he intended to make them a, quote, kingdom of priests, and he instructed them that they should move according to the ancient priesthood. He informed the women who were ordained to offices in the Relief Society that they had the authority to use spiritual gifts on behalf of other women. He told the women that, quote, the keys of the kingdom are about to be given to them as well as to the elders. By his later words and actions before he died, it is clear that Joseph Smith was referring here to the temple endowment, which would be given first to Emma Smith sometime before 28 September 1843 and then to other women. It is also clear that the fullness of the priesthood revealed through Joseph Smith must be embodied in both women and men, otherwise it is not a fullness, but only a portion of the priesthood. Nevertheless, and paradoxically, each woman and man who is endowed potentially bears the fullness within his or her own person. So it's kind of a complementarity, but complex. In addition to the promised priesthood keys bestowed by the endowment, Joseph Smith turned the key, his words, to the Relief Society on 28th of April, 1842. He said, I now turn the key to you in the name of God, and this society shall rejoice, and knowledge and intelligence shall flow down from this time. This is the beginning of better days to this society. This promise was never fulfilled. It is true that the Relief Society later flourished in Salt Lake during the last half of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th. Powerful women ran their own organization, raised and spent their own money, built their own buildings, had their own publications, and managed extensive welfare programs on their own. But all of this was taken away from them in the early 1970s when the church started the Correlation Program, both to centralize the church organization and put everything under male priesthood leadership. Today, the church likes to boast that the Relief Society is the largest women's organization in the world. What they fail to mention is that it is the largest organization that is run by men, who alone have the authority, the final authority, to manage the money, curriculum, and resources for this organization. In spite of the fact that the Relief Society has seen better days, it never fulfilled its prophetic destiny outlined by Joseph Smith, even in the 19th century. It is true that in the beginning, women like Eliza R. Snow understood their roles as priestesses and acted by this authority within the structure of the Relief Society. However, the women of the church have never wielded the priesthood key given to them by God through Joseph Smith. If they had, they would currently be functioning in priesthood offices within the official church structure. I am here today to call upon top LDS church leaders to be true to the revelation given by their founding prophet, Joseph Smith. The priesthood key given to women has never been taken away. God's promise to women still stands. If you leaders open your hearts in the same way President Spencer W. Kimball opened his in regard to ordaining black men in 1978, you will find that it is God's will that you ordain women to the priesthood and bring them into all the priesthood councils of the church from the first presidency down to the deacons' quorums. I plead with you to seriously consider this request. I make it neither defiantly nor proudly. I humbly beg you to fulfill the central mission of the restoration. In the official version of Moroni's appearance to Joseph Smith, the angel Moroni quotes the book of Malachi. Behold, I will reveal unto you the priesthood by the hand of Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Later, Joseph makes it clear that the priesthood brought by Elijah is the fullness of the priesthood bestowed in the temple. The priesthood is given to men and women equally through the endowment. Malachi says the whole earth will be utterly wasted without this priesthood because priesthood, I believe, at its heart, is the spiritual and divine power needed to mend our weary world. The purpose of the priesthood, as revealed in the scriptures, is identical to God's work. To bring about atonement, at-one-ment, to heal all the fragmented elements lying broken and scattered in ourselves and others, in our families, in our communities, and in the cosmos. The priesthood is the power to reconcile the contraries of the universe into a living whole and to heal and perfect them. The work of the priesthood is to seal or bind together not only the families of the earth, but also spirit and body, male and female, heaven and earth, humanity and divinity. We live in a world utterly being wasted by greed and violence, a world ripped apart by ethnic and class warfare. We live in a world where women worldwide are forced into sexual slavery, are beaten and abused, and are given fewer resources than men in terms of food, health care, and education. Husband and wife team Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn document the wide extent of these problems in their urgently compelling book, Half the Sky, published in 2009. They also demonstrate that empowering women through education and microfinance is the sure key to improving the overall well-being of any community. When women thrive, hunger, poverty, and disease diminish for the whole population because women spread their resources to their children and extended families. Empowering women contributes to the well-being of any community. This is crucial. This, for me, is the bottom line of the priesthood argument. It is the heart of why I believe the LDS Church needs to extend priesthood to women in its regular structure. Gender equality improves the well-being of any community, spiritually, socially, intellectually, politically, economically, and even if these abuses are not as extreme as they are in third world countries. Women will never be equal to men in the church until their priesthood rights are acknowledged and they are included in all the priesthood councils in the church. Women's voices and concerns will not be valued until women are ordained in the present structure. I am not saying that all problems would immediately disappear. And of course, women do not always use power wisely. They are as susceptible to human error as are men. We can look at other religious organizations with women priests, such as the Community of Christ, our friends there, to see both the challenges and the benefits. But the gospel of Christ calls us to the equality of treatment of all, whether black or white, bond or free, male or female. The LDS Church should ordain women because it is the just and right thing to do. It is a necessary step to bring about a Zion society. It is the will of our God, male and female, because without equality, we cannot attain to their divine image. Those traditions that have extended priesthood to women can attest to the fact that their churches have been revitalized. They have discovered that the service and talents of women are more fully utilized when women can serve in priestly offices, and these churches are abundantly blessed by women's gifts and increased contributions, which only happen if women are in the structure. So how do we go about convincing LDS church leaders that they should ordain women to the priesthood? I know that my plea today is likely to fall on deaf or even hostile ears. A recent survey, if it is to be believed, in the book American Grace, reports that 48% of Mormon men believe women should be ordained, while only 10% of women believe that they should be ordained. A startling figure. Again, I'm not, you know, statistics and all of that. So my question is it women we need to convince first before we can convince male leaders? In the 30-plus years I have worked on this issue, the resistance I see from Mormon women can be summarized into three basic arguments. First of all, the first group says, we don't want the priesthood because it is not God's will. If it were, he would tell the prophet. We agree with what our leaders have said, that women have a different role in God's kingdom, motherhood. We are already equal, but different. The second group says, we don't want the priesthood, but we wish women were given more control over their own organizations, the Relief Society, and the primary. We wish that they could make more decisions and have their own resources. The third group sees priesthood itself as a sign of the problem with both Mormonism and religion in general. They say, the priesthood organization is corrupt because of its hierarchical corporate nature. We are out of here and want nothing to do with this system. Women should not cooperate in any way to support the abusive LDS priesthood system. How can any liberal feminist woman do this? Now, I don't have time to answer all of these responses fully, but I want to acknowledge their full validity. They are real concerns that women have. I don't dismiss these positions lightly. But I want to suggest some possible directions for further discussion, which we need. First, one of the main reasons I emphasize Joseph Smith's statements to the Relief Society is that they are a foundational theological argument to believers, if you don't believe, then it doesn't matter, right, that God does want Mormon women to have priesthood. Second, while giving women more control over their organizations would certainly be a positive step forward for empowering women, and all feminists have supported this idea, there would still be a glass ceiling for women because the women's organizations are still and would be subordinate to the male priesthood quorums. Without a woman apostle in the first presidency, women will never have the spiritual nor temporal authority of men. Third, I completely agree that there is an inherent problem with the nature and structure of the current priesthood system in the LDS Church because it promotes a hierarchical, exclusive view of spiritual authority. I have always argued that we should not only ordain women, but we need to rethink the structure and to restructure the priesthood organization. We need to move away from restricted and outmoded models of priesthood hierarchy toward the establishment of a genuine religious community governed by a true lay priesthood. A kingdom of priestesses and priests with equal right to know and speak in the name of the Godhead, in whose image we are made. But in the meantime, in the practical here and now, the majority of Mormon women will stay in the church because they are committed to it spiritually and socially. Even if we are non-believers and don't like institutional priesthood hierarchy, we must admit that it affects millions of women's everyday lives. So as concerned feminists, we should work for change, both in current policy about women's ordination and in the way priesthood itself is viewed. Even among Mormon women who believe that women should have priesthood, there are divisions about how this priesthood should be promoted and used. I see two main camps with subdivisions. First, there are those who feel that women need to exercise their spiritual and priestly gifts privately as a beginning step. Not only do they believe this is the way to avoid the abuse of power inherent in the public priesthood structure, but they feel it models a new vision for the meaning of priesthood and acts as a spiritual call to the church for change. This approach advocates moving behind the scene. Most of the women who follow this pattern believe that they have been called by God's Spirit. Others feel they were ordained to the priesthood in the temple, and they give blessings and do other priestly acts, such as administering the sacrament, in the name of the Melchizedek priesthood privately. There are those in this group who believe that their private actions and prayers will eventually move the leaders to ask God for women's ordination. The second camp believes in public action. This doesn't mean they think private spiritual practices and prayers are unimportant, but they believe we need to be vocal and public in our requests from leaders for women's ordination. Change cannot happen without public activism that puts our membership at risk. We have to face that. In June, Lori Winder posted on this topic on the Exponent 2 blog. Again, if you haven't read it, you should. Using the example of the Roman Catholic Women Priest Movement, she was the first to ask the question I continue today. Should Mormon women follow the example of their Catholic sisters by pursuing rogue ordinations? Lori argues that we should seriously consider this type of action, not only because we need new life in the old women and priesthood debate that's been going on in Mormon feminism for a long time, but because the RCWP is based on an impassioned commitment to both their religious tradition and to change. The Catholic women in this movement feel called to priesthood. As Lori states, I am struck by the spiritual power of this conviction. It is what transforms each ordination from a political stunt into an act of sacred disobedience. I love Lori's phrase, sacred disobedience. I want to clarify here where I stand in this priesthood debate. From my first Sunstone presentation in 1984, I have argued that women should claim both the spiritual dimension of priesthood, which is what the scriptures call the power of the priesthood, right, and the right to priesthood offices within the church organization. I have publicly urged the church to acknowledge women's priesthood callings and to ordain them to priesthood offices. I have used both the statements of Joseph Smith and the Temple Endowment as historical and theological justification for my views. Now, I know that many of my Mormon sisters have negative feelings about Joseph Smith and the Temple. I am sympathetic, and I have no inclination to persuade you to accept what you feel you cannot. But whether you think the Temple bestows actual priesthood or not, Joseph Smith's statements are a strong argument against the damaging idea that priesthood is eternally only for men within the Mormon tradition, which has been asserted by such leaders as Gordon Hinckley, Boyd Packer, and Dallin Oaks. While I honor women using priesthood privately and think it is beneficial, I firmly believe we must act publicly too and be willing to take the consequences. Excommunication is painful, as I know from personal experience. My refusal to be silent on the issue of Mormon women's right to priesthood ordination was a central issue in the disciplinary action taken against me. Like my Catholic sisters, I see my excommunication as a man-made law. The church has the power to take away my church membership, but it cannot remove what has been sealed by the Holy Spirit of promise. I know that my ordinances, including being endowed with priesthood power in the temple, are still valid. Now, why am I turning again to this thing? I mean, some of you may think I've beaten this topic to death, right? And maybe I have. But I see us at a point where the discussion is very valid again. And I believe that whatever disagreements we Mormon women have about the nature, source, or even purpose of priesthood, I think that we should act from where we stand to improve both the spiritual and institutional power and authority of women in whatever way we can. If we are more in the mainstream, we can pray for the church leaders to receive a revelation to ordain women to the priesthood. If we feel spiritually inclined, we can exercise our gifts, giving blessings, healing prayers, teaching, and writing with priestly authority, expanding the scope of women's action as much as possible in our own circles. How we think about ourselves changes the quality of our actions. If we see ourselves acting with spiritual priestly power, if we feel called, we can pursue rogue ordinations. I think it's a great idea. By getting men we trust to ordain us to priesthood offices. And then we can hold private sacrament meetings or do other priestly acts. And publicizing these acts may work for change. We need to discuss that. There is another way women could participate in rogue ordinations in Mormonism. If, as I have described above, Joseph Smith conferred priesthood keys on women when he set up the Relief Society, then we women could ordain each other to priesthood offices without the permission of men. I see the key that Joseph Smith talked about is different than the keys in the temple. So even if you don't like temple priesthood, there is this other way. The theological precedents for angelic visitors conferring keys upon Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, and then Joseph and Oliver performing ordinances for each other, reveals the pattern for women ordaining each other. I understand all the historical problems with these Mormon priesthood revelations, but that is beside the point here. The point is that Mormon tradition contains multiple avenues for women claiming priesthood. Now, no matter which approach you think is better of those I've outlined above, for me, it is essential that women cannot function in the priesthood structure of the church. I mean, this is a crucial point. Without the acknowledgement of and permission from male priesthood leaders. This is always the conundrum we can come back to. Because if we're going out and doing our own thing and sort of starting an old church of only women, we haven't really changed anything. That's the question. So rogue ordinations face the same problem as temple ordinations or spiritual callings. Even if a woman has been ordained by a Mormon male with legitimate authority through the regular priesthood channels, she cannot exercise her priesthood within the structure of the church. She has to perform her priestly acts in private settings. Even if women make such acts public by putting them on YouTube, still these actions are outside church venues. Of course, the same is true for men, too. In order to use their priesthood in any kind of administrative or sacramental way, they must be ordained to an office and set apart or installed in a calling. And men are always accountable to male leaders above them in the hierarchy as part of a priesthood order. What can Mormon women learn from their Catholic sisters in the RCWP? I want to address briefly some of the 10 points that Jill has raised for us to consider. First of all, Catholic women have not been able to change their tradition's position on female ordinations, while Episcopal women have, as Jill explains. Now, neither Jill nor I have the time to explore the reasons, but I think it is clear that Mormon tradition is more like the Catholic. The centralized, hierarchical, infallible structures of both the Catholic and LDS priesthood orders contribute to the difference, as well as the conservative stance of both organizations. Women in both traditions face enormous obstacles to bring about change, but I do not believe it is hopeless for either group. I remain an idealist committed to work for change, even if the obstacles seem insurmountable. Number two, for the Catholics, both the women and the church, validity and apostolic succession are essential, according to Jill. This is true for Mormons, too. Legitimate priesthood authority is central to the way Mormons define the restoration and purpose of the present-day LDS Church. However, I believe Mormon women are in a stronger position theologically than Catholic women. All the statements and actions of Joseph Smith make it possible to question the notion that it is God's will to exclude women from the priesthood. I also believe the doctrine of the Heavenly Mother can be used to validate women's right to priesthood. As Jill explains, the Catholic tradition has argued that a priest must act in persona Christi on the belief that a priest is a sacramental sign of Jesus Christ and therefore must be male. Now, Mormons too believe that Jesus Christ is the great high priest and the head of the priesthood orders under the Father. But if God the Mother is a joint partner with God the Father, then she must have priesthood as well as godhood. I realize that this is a circular argument, right? Since Mormons don't generally define Heavenly Mother in this way. But still, my point is that it has theological possibility, and we've got to mine whatever we can. 3, Jill argues that since the Church controls the sacred spaces in Catholicism, this makes it difficult for the RCWP movement to find places for their sacramental actions. Though Mormons don't face this exact same problem, since they believe almost any space can be sacralized, still Mormons have a very hard time accepting the legitimacy of actions or doctrines that are outside designated LDS venues and forums. 4, Jill contrasts the secret catacomb ordinations with the very public ordinations. Did you do this in your version today? You did still, right. Reported by the press through news reports and videos. I see both types of ordination as important if the Mormon women priest movement is going to have any success. Again, I'm urging that from wherever you stand, that that's where you move. 5, Jill contrasts criticism from the male hierarchy with criticism from feminist scholars and theologians. I have seen a similar pattern in the Mormon feminist movement in the last 30 years. Criticism from the hierarchy in some ways helps the movement. Making the bear growl means that at least the men are paying attention, which is a step forward, right? On the other hand, internal fights among women are very devastating to the movement, which to me doesn't mean we have to agree, but we have to cooperate. This is a huge problem, but an inevitable one that we need to deal with more creatively and charitably. Mormon feminists, too, have had that complementarity debate without any clear consensus. And so do we need to agree on doctrine? I don't think we do. I don't think it's possible to either get or healthy to get women to agree on approaches or theory. Because the resistance to women's ordination is so strong, and because priesthood is essential for women's equality within the church, I believe we need all these approaches and voices. Women need to use whatever tactic feels right to them. I know that the means we use are connected to our results, so it is complicated. But still, I think it's a mistake to destroy the movement with internal criticisms and divisions. The question is, how can we work as a coalition, agreeing on some central points while respecting individual choices on how to act on specific questions? For me, that's the discussion we need to have. 6, like the Catholic women, Mormon feminists have also debated about the tension between transgression and traditionalism. It is impossible to stay within the tradition without emulating much of the church's existing structures. But still, women are seriously challenging central aspects of that current organization, as I have noted above. Since this tension is inevitable, unless you simply leave the tradition, we need to use it to our advantage. We have to think hard about how to change the structure without destroying it. After all, if we don't want to be Mormon, we can join the Episcopals. Though that is not easy, by the way, if you want to be accepted as a priest there. But that's another issue. 7, and this is my final point in response to Jill. Jill says that the RCWP has been helped enormously by interfaith relationships. Mormon feminists certainly need more interfaith dialogue and cooperation. The Mormon Women's Forum has sponsored a number of such panels in the past, but not nearly enough, in my opinion, and I don't remember including Catholic women, which I think we need to do. We have a lot to learn from our sisters in other traditions. We can also pray for each other. I believe in prayer, and find ways to be mutually supportive. I can see the possibility of a fruitful partnership between Mormon women and Catholic women from the interaction I've already had with Jill. I hope that this is a beginning. Now, I began my paper with a plea to the leaders of the LDS Church to accept the legitimacy of women's call to priesthood ordination. I also asked them to seek a revelation from God to reconfirm Joseph Smith's promises to women of priesthood keys and power. I want to end my paper with a plea to the membership of the church to open their hearts to a new vision of what priesthood could mean in Mormonism. My vision of priesthood equality for men and women does not create a different church, a different Mormonism. Rather, it is a fulfillment of the promises of the restoration as a return to the fullness of Christ's gospel, the gospel that promises not only spiritual birth, but spiritual maturation, where men and women work together without fear or competition. This view of priesthood works toward the ideal of Zion that eliminates class divisions. It is a call for equality in both earthly and heavenly things. It is not about women supplanting men. I have often heard the fear expressed that if women had priesthood in the LDS Church, the men would leave in droves, or simply become inactive, happily leaving the work to the women. I don't believe this. I have always felt this view is an insult to the committed, intelligent, spiritually minded men I know. But it is true that ordaining women and including them in the priesthood structure would or should make us rethink the balance of power between men and women as it is in the church today. I would hope that if women were ordained, there wouldn't be an attempt to still keep top leadership in the hands of men. I have already said we need women apostles. I also believe that the quorum of the apostles should include representatives of all races. And if I had my way, we'd have gay apostles too, but we'll see. As a church, we have not fully faced our racism or our sexism. What role should men take in the movement for women's priesthood ordination in the LDS Church? Ultimately, of course, ordination of women will not take place without the cooperation of men. They have to be willing to let women into the priesthood order and to honor women's priestly authority. I call upon my brothers to work with us. I know that some of you have already risked your membership by speaking publicly about this issue or even by doing rogue ordinations. We very much need your support and ideas. But I believe the initiative and leadership for this movement must come from women themselves. Otherwise, we are defeating the very goal we are pursuing, gender equality. This is not merely an abstract concept. It affects all of us on a daily basis, how we interact with others, how we feel about ourselves and our potential, what we think we can do and be. I call upon my sisters, not just here, but in the mainstream church, to have a new vision of yourselves. Think of yourselves as priestesses, as instruments for the power of God, of the divine spirit working through you to bless and revive our world. I have been privileged to be in circles of sisters giving blessings to other sisters on many occasions. We don't follow the typical church pattern when we do this. We touch each other, but don't necessarily put hands on head. It may be a gentle hand on the back or shoulder, a clasping of hands or rubbing of feet or arms. Not just woman, one woman is the voice, but whoever is moved upon by the Spirit gives her love, her thoughts, her inspiration, one woman after another. Light flows, images appear, words heal, touch connects us. We see ourselves in new ways. We have hope. We feel renewed. We envision new possibilities. We can dream again. This is the power of women's priesthood at work. My prayer is that it can fill the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Put on your strength, O daughters of Zion. I am paraphrasing Joseph Smith's interpretation in D&C 113 of a prophecy from Isaiah. Joseph explains that for Zion to put on her strength is to put on the authority of the priesthood which she, Zion, has a right to by lineage, to return to that power which she had lost. I think that the gendered pronouns here are prophetic. The LDS Church will never be right with God, nor can it fulfill its mission to bless the whole world until women are ordained to the priesthood and begin to act in the priestly roles, including apostle and prophet. We were called to this mission in 1842, 6 years before the famous Seneca Falls Conference that led the way in women's rights in this country. We should have been in the vanguard. Instead, we have dragged far behind. We, the daughters of Zion, must act now. We must put on our strength, the authority of our priesthood, in order to prepare for the return of Zion, our heavenly mother, who is the great high priestess. Thank you. Discussion going. Hopefully we've gotten you either angry or excited or something, and that, you know, we're both, Jill and I, are calling for action. But discussion often comes first. It's good to have discussion first. So I think, let me see if I can get one of these microphones free. And come up here so that you can...
I too have had, my name is Renee Shaw. I too have had a lot of these frustrations that you ladies have. I would have considered myself a Mormon feminist until about 2 years ago when I was walking in the park over at Liberty Park. That's where I live, walking through some trees. And a voice came to me and said, "You work for me now." I'm like, "Who is this?" She said, "Heavenly Mother." And I had lots of questions for her. And one of them was, "Why don't we have the priesthood?" And she said, "Because you already have it. Men cannot give you the priesthood that comes from me, because it comes from me, Heavenly Mother. And what I would like to do," and she said, very soon, the issue is that it's not being acknowledged. If we go to the temple, they don't give us the priesthood, but they act as if we already have it. And that's why, because we do, women, we have it. The problem is that it's not being acknowledged yet, and it will be soon. She says that very, very soon we will be seeing women taking on the roles of bishop-like jobs. We will be acknowledged for what the powers of heaven that she has given us, that we already have. So be patient. It's coming. And tune into the Spirit and know how to exercise your priesthood. Because, like I said, you already have it. She loves you, and she's very excited for the women that are standing up in their power. Thank you.
I have no statement to make. I have a question. And I may be wrong on my statistics, because I like statistics, but I always get them mixed up. So, I thought that the Episcopal Church was losing membership, that the Catholic Church is gaining membership, and that the conservative churches are growing. And my question is, are the more, quote, dependent, obedient, docile women staying in and joining the conservative religions, and the more independent women are joining that none of the above group? And so you may never find that critical mass in a more conservative religion to change it. They'll just leave. Mm-hmm.
It's a huge problem.
And so the statistics seem to say if the women rise, the numbers go down. Is that right?
I can just say a couple things. I know, the Catholic Church has recently said to Episcopalians who are unhappy about women's ordination and the ordination of homosexuals, come on in, we'll take you. And so there are Episcopalians who are leaving that church to go to Catholicism. Catholicism is not growing. It's about, in the U.S., it's stagnant because of immigration. There is a statistic where that former Catholics are like the second largest denomination in this country, because about 1 in 10 Catholics leave the church, if we were to call them a denomination. But yes, I mean, it's true that I think a lot of it, this is my biggest concern for RCWP, is that I think as the older generation leaves, the younger generation has already left. So that is my concern for their future.
And I have seen the same thing in Mormon feminism, both with older generation. I know hundreds of women personally who have left the church.
I know hundreds of women personally who have left the LDS church because of feminist issues. And I think I know there are a lot of younger women who the older women sort of struggled with the issues, and a lot of the younger women are saying, we're just out of here. So it is a huge issue. And I've read some of this, these statistics, and that it is true that, and I heard a program on NPR, The Ultimate Source of Truth, right, that that often the people who are not part of organized religions, it's not as though sort of all the more liberal or intellectual people are completely getting rid of religion, but they're not as involved in the sort of structural religions. And so that is a real problem with, you know, the action that we're calling for. No question.
Let's make sure we get a few other.
Thanks for both of your presentations. I had the opportunity in February to go to Sunstone in Kirkland, and they had a few panels there from women of the Community of Christ who had been ordained to the priesthood. And I think perhaps one of the things that you may have considered and is certainly worthy of discussion is the experience of the Community of Christ with ordaining women, and to see what could be learned from that. Unfortunately, in their situation, what happened was they had a large splintering of the church. And so they have basically two factions of the church, one that no longer recognizes the independence group and instead formed their own conservative. And the women and men both left in that one. And so I'm not sure how that's reconcilable, but it's certainly worthy of looking at and considering.
The Mormon Women's Forum has actually had a number of occasions for a dialogue with the Church of Christ women. And I think I really believe that the interfaith dialogue is very important, both in the sense of giving each other strength, but also learning from each other. And the Church of Christ did have a big segment. I don't know, Lamina, if you know what the statistic is of how many members they lost. 20%, which is huge. And of course, also, I'm trying to think of her last name, Robin, who...
Lockhart.
Linkhart, that's right. She gave a talk a couple of years ago at Sunstone, so we've had a lot of presentations from Church of Christ here about the issue that, you know, the whole issue of how do we incorporate women in the system, you know, are they sort of rising or do we keep them kind of more on this other level of management? You know, again, this is a very important part of the interfaith dialogue, I believe, that we can learn from each other and look at the challenges and the advantages. So we probably have time for a couple more comments, questions.
So I'm kind of wondering about your comment about did we want to educate us all first? Because I think that there is, I mean, for myself, I feel like, I want the priesthood, but the powers that be say that's a sin, essentially. And so I think that's why there was the separation of congregation of women and the men who's like, wow, you know, they're disobeying God. And so if we had like a PR campaign, you know, of Joseph's, I'm giving the key to you women, and that just didn't get fulfilled. And so if more Mormon women could feel comfortable about it is my right, it is my birthright, it is okay with God, that we're not doing this big sin, that then I think we'd have to take that step first before we take the step of me even doing the rogue ordinations or whatever. I know I've struggled with, I've actually become a shamanic practitioner, you know, where you have like power of heaven to do things, and I've struggled with, because of my Mormon conflict, do I have that power, you know? So it's a strong thing.
No, I'm very glad you made that comment, Sue, because I think that this is a huge obstacle that we have to discuss that. Have you seen that in the RCWP, the whole question about is this going against, you know, women's nature? Or also, a lot of women feel, I don't want the priesthood because I don't want to abuse power.
I've heard a lot of women give that argument as well.
I think I was struck by your statistic that 10%, only 10% of Mormon women say that women should be ordained. Yeah, and it's not that low in Catholicism, but it is lower among Catholic women than Catholic men. So it's a similar tension that these women feel.
So my question is, in your paper, there is implied not only the ordination of women in the Mormon paradigm, but a lot of other change. And every time I hear this issue come up, I very rarely hear the issue isolated. Like, we should take the Mormon faith and practice and then bring women into the priesthood fold. Do you think that, and oftentimes, for really good reason, the reasons that different people want or how they want to exercise feminine priesthood is very diverse. We've seen that just right. In the comments. Do you think that might be negatively impacting your message to the church, in that if you say on one hand we should ordain women, and the other time you're saying we need to change the way we do ordination circles, we need to change the way we're touching, and then we need to change the corporate culture, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Not that I'm critical of any of those things, but do you think that's diluting the message?
In terms of, effectiveness. Very good question. And I agree that that can be an issue, because part of the resistance to change is the fear of loss and the fear that somehow it'll destroy what I love or know or have power over, right? And so, I mean, in spite of the fact that I tend to be more idealistic, I've come to the point where I'm thinking we better be more pragmatic. And so the pragmatic issue of, let's just ordain women and then we're going to sort out the whole issue of how priesthood is used and so forth, which in a sense is what happened in the Church of Christ, or you could argue the Episcopals too, or a lot of the others. They made the change, and then you struggle with how that itself, the very fact that you included women, is beginning to change the organization. And so I really believe that that's the way we have to go.
Margaret, you've been accidentally saying Church of Christ, it's community.
Oh, Community of Christ. I'm so sorry. Thank you, Levina, for correcting me on that. Community of Christ. The Church of Christ is quite a different group. Indeed. We don't want to confuse them. So we're going to let come up, and you can be our last commenter.
Well, you're aware that Sherry Dew and Virginia Pierce have come out with a book about the Relief Society Minutes, the Nauvoo Relief Society Minutes, and of course it's going to be quite different than what you're saying. So I see this huge polarization happening at this moment. How will you address, have you read their book, and what do you think about it?
I haven't yet. I've heard about it, so I obviously need to read it. But to me, what we see here, though, is that you have the minutes online. It takes, one minute to find those through Google. And yet we have this official, this response to kind of control the vision of it. But I think that's a real obstacle that we face. It's a huge obstacle, because how many are going to go online and look at the minutes versus read the book? So, there are huge obstacles we face, but I haven't given up yet. So thank you very much for your attendance at this session.